You're listening to On the Same Page, a podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library.
Welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. We're your hosts. I'm Abby.
And I'm Katie. We're librarians at the Central Library.
For this episode, we've got a recording of an event that took place at the Northside Library last fall. It features a panel of veterans sharing their stories.
But before we get to that, we've got book chat.
All right, Katie, what did you read?
Yeah, I just read a book by Matt Haig. He's a novelist, but he's also written some nonfiction works based on like mental health and mental illnesses. So his first one is called Reasons to Stay Alive, which is really a great book about his own struggles with depression. He talks about having this anxiety attack when he was 24 and, you know, almost committed suicide. And so this book is about his journey getting out of that and a lot of great advice on if other people are struggling with that as well. Okay. But I just recently read the follow-up to that one. It's called Notes on a Nervous Planet.
Ooh.
And it's a similar book. It's more of a broader question about mental health and in the world in the 21st century. So, you know, in the first book, he kind of tackles this question of why should I stay alive? And in this book, Notes on a Nervous Planet, it's more how do you stay sane and human in a world that's making you more anxious and mad? And so he talks about, you know, our addiction to modern technology, social media, and all of the negative ramifications of that. But he does it in a way, I think, that doesn't fall, like, into cliches.
Oh, that's nice.
So some books can kind of do that, just believe in yourself and, you know, but he's a lot of humor and a lot of frankness in these two books that I think is really makes the book a lot more memorable.
Oh, great.
So what have you read lately?
I read a young adult novel called The Sisterhood by A.J. Granger, and that just came out this February, and it takes place in Wales. I've been trying to read books that are set outside the United States, so just checked that box. But it's told from a couple different perspectives. Mainly it follows the younger sister of a girl who has been missing. She's run away. She's been gone for about 4 months. And the other perspective that it follows is a young woman who has recently joined a cult. And so there's this, like, so there's really high tension the whole time because this, the main kind of perspective is trying to find her sister, and then there's this cult that keeps appearing more and more in the rest of the story, and it just builds the drama the entire time. The main perspective and the perspective of the girl and the cult, they are sort of intertwined in an interesting way that gets more complex as the story goes on, and it just keeps the tension very high the whole time. So, very engaging.
Cool. Next, we hear a recording of an event that took place at the Northside Library on Thursday, November 8th. Captain Bob Abbott, the host of WINA's Coming Home Well, moderated a panel discussion with local veterans from various wars over the past 60 years who shared their stories of the challenges of war, the trials of returning home. We are sharing it now due to the upcoming rededication of the Dogwood Vietnam Memorial during the Dogwood Festival.
Thank you all for coming out tonight. Great to see you all. Welcome to Local Heroes, Stories of Courage. My name is Evan Stankovics. I'm the Adult Programming Librarian here at the Northside Library. And we're honored and delighted to host this special panel this evening. I thank each of our panel, who will be up here momentarily, for their service and their time, taking their time out to be here tonight with us. I'd also like to thank Cindy Thompson in the back of the room, and of course, Captain Bob Abbott, who will be moderating tonight, and also Jeannie, who's hiding around the corner from Mission Barbecue, who supplied the food tonight. So thank you very much. Lastly, this evening's program is being audio recorded for the JMRL podcast On the Same Page, and that is accessible through our website, jmrl.org, so you can hear a recording of this program and many other programs on our website. With that said, please help me welcome Captain Bob Abbott.
Thank you. I'll be here all week. Try the veal, tip your servers. So, I have intro music? That's so awesome. I feel like a world wrestling star right now. I'm Captain Bob Abbott. I'm the host of Coming Home Well. If you don't know what Coming Home Well is, we have a handy-dandy, very cute little postcard sitting somewhere around you that you can look at, and I promise that the gentleman in the photo is clothed underneath the flag. I just had it draped in a flag to piss off the vets that, no, you're not supposed to do that because I'm kind of a jerk. Our show is a radio program on WINA Saturday mornings from 8 to 9 that focuses on educating civilians about veteran issues. So it's vets talking to vets, but we switch a little bit to where we're talking to the civilian listener. We're talking to our average demographic for a radio listener is a mom of a veteran or a military service member. So that's really who we're talking to, right? Her name is Mary, and she's 52 years old. I mean, I can really, like, I have my demographic defined. We then also kick it out as a podcast that goes out. That demographic is different. It's about young 30s, and it's about 60% veteran is who we're talking to. His name's Chuck. So we're trying to help Chuck. We're also trying to help you civilians understand us. I was speaking at Northrop Grumman earlier today, and we were talking about this disconnect that is felt by a lot of veterans when they come home. And we kind of honed it down to it's a language barrier. It's pretty much it. We all speak English until us military members go off to basic and we learn a whole nother language of stuff to where we can say things like, ha, no bohica for me, Big Mo, beer lights on, which means to any veteran that I'm no longer going to get screwed over by the military because I now have transfer orders for me to go to another location and I believe that I would go partake in an adult beverage at the bar. We just shortened it because of the military. So this whole radio program, this whole panel discussion is to educate civilians so that you can learn our language better. We don't want to make you fluent. We just want to teach you some of the words, some of the lingo, so that you can talk to your veteran. Because your veteran is at a very high risk of suicide, quite bluntly. And by you being able to have a stronger and a better and more meaningful conversation with them, then potentially and hopefully that can save that vet's life. So that's our goal. But I can't do it alone, which is why I have the most amazing guests on my show. And today, we have the most amazing guest. His name is Astro. He's a dog.
Hi, Astro.
I would like to welcome Bruce Eads up. There you go, Bruce. Here's your seat. You want to say hi? Say hi. Just sit, man. Okay. We're so white. All right. Then we have Helen Stowe and Heather Mertzer. And if y'all can give a round of applause to our speakers. And, of course, Astro. In preparation for this, the goal here was to have an array of combatants, which you are legal combatants from the various wars going back to, I believe we go back to Vietnam in the 60s. 60s or 70s, Bruce?
67, 68.
Okay. So, Bruce Eads, you served in the Vietnam War, 67, 68. You were a Marine.
Right.
And then you came home. Were you done with the military, or did you continue to serve? You were out.
So no, I served in Quantico for a while until okay. I got my time.
So you did your time yeah. during the Vietnam conflict.
And then we had a nice amicable separation, I guess you'd call it.
Those were always the best ones. Oh, was I? Oh, no, it is recording. Okay, great. And then Heather Mercer, you served when I served in Afghanistan.
Yes.
But you, what years were you there?
Afghanistan, in the military, I was there 2009 to 2012. Okay. I'm sorry.
And you were Army 82nd?
No, I was actually Georgia Army National Guard. Airborne qualified.
So airborne qualified is a big deal amongst us military folks. It means you're legally allowed to jump out of planes without getting yelled at by the JetBlue employees. And then, Helen, you were Army?
Army.
And Sergeant First Class, if I recall correctly?
I retired as Sergeant First Class.
And then you served in both Iraq and Afghanistan?
Twice in Afghanistan, once in Desert Storm and Iraq.
Wow. So the whole goal tonight is to try and compare and contrast what the lifestyle is. And I should probably ask of the audience, how many are veterans? Okay, so we have a handful, a smattering. Thank you, thank you. Welcome home. I don't say thank you for your service. I say welcome home. And we're really, really glad that you're back. And of those veterans, how many have deployed to a theater of operation conflict? So our goal is to share with the rest of you that things have changed a little bit, but also things kind of remain the same. So, Bruce, we'll start with you. Let me check my notes. Oh, that's right. I don't have any because I'm winging it. Were you with that? That makes two of us. Can I sit, Bruce? Is that
okay?
Okay, very good. I don't want to offend. Dastra's lying down. I won't do that. So, Bruce, when you went to Vietnam, 67, 68, That was fairly early on in the conflict. It was pre-Tet, yes?
It was Tet.
You were there for Tet.
I was there for Tet. Tet was January 31st, 1968. I got there. It's kind of ironic, Captain Bob. I got there on May 15th of 1967. That day, a young man from Charlottesville, Virginia, named Charlie Milton, got killed in Vietnam. He was a Marine. I didn't know him. Went to Alamo High School, but the draft was in effect, of course, and we went as replacement troops. We didn't go as a unit like you folks do today. You know, y'all trained together, go over for a deployment. We went, Marines went for 13 months. The Army went for 12. They always teased us and said, you know, we can do in 12 what it takes a Marine to do 13. And then the ironic thing was they went over on ship, and that 20 days counted. And the Marines, they flew us over on one of those commercial jets with the pretty ladies that we never saw again. But anyway.
It's nice to know that 50 years later you don't hold on to that one. So when you went over there as a replacement, what were your thoughts going on in your mind? I mean, you are in this beautiful airplane with beautiful ladies,
yeah,
and you're going over there knowing that you're replacing a person that's no more.
Well, you get off the plane in Da Nang, and the tarmac is about 130, and you say, damn, it's hot, you know, and it's too hot, really, and you can't acclimatize, but you get about 24 hours to acclimatize before they send you to your unit. If you're very unlucky, they put you on a C-130 and send you up north to Khe Sanh or somewhere like that. I wasn't that unlucky. I went south to south of Da Nang to the 52nd Arvins, but I was a linguist. I went to language school in Monterey, so I spoke Vietnamese, so.
It's a good place to go.
Yeah.
I was a linguist.
But I did end up in Khe Sanh. And I guess we went up there in December.
So we'll move forward a little bit to the Persian Gulf War. You said that you served in the Gulf War. How'd you get there? Taxi? Commercial airliner? Or did they fly in like a C-5? What was your, Helen, your arrival experience like to the Gulf?
When we went to the Gulf War, we did not have any of our packs, or even our weapons. We landed, and we had nothing. There was nothing there for us. It was just desert. And my first commander's, what he wants to say to us was, there is north, there is south. If anyone comes from there, run that way.
Brilliant.
Oh, okay. So that was our first commander's, yeah.
Commander's brief.
Yeah, and it was totally different from when we go to war now, because we have our pack and everything's with us, even our weapon. We had nothing, just the dirt in front of us, and it was very, yeah.
So when you went into Iraq, you went fully equipped?
Fully equipped.
With all your gear?
With all our gear. You left Fort Drum with your gear, with everything.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And then Heather, for Afghanistan, was it the same, similar?
Somewhat similar. I went to Iraq first, then Afghanistan, and both we flew over in commercial airliners to your first, we'll call it point of entry. For Iraq, it was Kuwait, and for Afghanistan, it was Kyrgyzstan.
Kyrgyzstan.
I only spent a month there.
The coldest place on earth, by the way.
Yeah, so we flew commercial airliner to those locations, and then you usually got loaded on a C-130. And that took you into country, as we like to call it. Usually nosedive into Baghdad, because you don't want to get shot down coming in. And people would throw up, which was fantastic for those.
No, it wasn't.
Did you?
All right, well, shush. So we have to explain, for those who don't know the difference between a C-5, C-130, C-5 is the really big plane that the front end, the nose opens up, you can actually load a tank in it. The C-130s are little ones that you see that have the props, the four props. A lot of people jumping out the back who are not the high up on the ASVAB score level. Sorry, Heather. But have all of you ridden in a C-130? Oh, all right. This is a fun one because I've been in C-130s. What are the seats like? Because this is that experience that y'all don't see in the movies.
I'm trying to think of a movie that you actually do get to see, Band of Brothers, maybe. So they're netted seats, yeah, and you sit on the sides, and then the interior rows, there's two of them, and they face the outboard. And so you're just sitting there in nets, like just sinking and sinking.
And you get armrests and everything to hold on to when they land, right?
Right, yeah. Right, no. There's no armrest, no service, no full bathroom.
It's better than a dish and a half, right?
Yes.
A little better.
Yeah.
There's nets behind you that as you start to land, you have to somehow, while you've got all your pack and gear on you, weave your arms into the nets to hold on, or else you're going to end up in the dude's lap like three people down. And when you're sitting, you're not sitting like you are. You're sitting like this with your buddies. Your knee is in their crotch for hours. And the whole thing smells like JPA, which that smell will probably give me more nightmares than anything else. It's not exactly a commercial airliner with the lovely ladies. And as the Air Force people are kind of rude about it, they're like, we just use the bathroom. Like, I can't move. I can't move for 2 hours. So each of you, when you arrived in country, you said that you had 24 hours to acclimatize. It's kind of about the same amount of time before you go out on a mission. So we'll start with the more recent one, and then we'll go back in time. And Heather, were you outside the wire on patrols? What were those like? I mean, what were your thought pattern as you were going out there? First of all, what was your mission as you went outside the wire?
All right, so mission varied, but we'll go with my experience in northern Afghanistan. I was with an infantry company, which in today's progressive world, women get to go down and play with the grunts, and I was working intelligence, so that was my mission, working with a infantry company, which is about 120 guys out in a base somewhere in the middle of wherever they're at. And so my mission was to meet with intelligence officers, usually with the Afghan National Police, and just glean whatever information we could glean from them to pass to our command to keep our troops safer in their day-to-day operations. So I didn't go out every day, but when I was doing this mission for about 4 or 5 months, I probably went out 2 or 3 times a week outside the wire, as we call it, the Constantino wire around your base. So you go outside the wire, mounted patrols in an up-armored Humvee, or we had some, I call them SUVs on steroids at that point, mine-resistant.
The MRAPs?
MRAPs.
Those are those big honking ones that have the V-hole that you may have seen.
Yeah.
They're in a lot of TV shows and movies, the MRAPs.
I don't watch them. So I go out, and I'm usually along for the ride, usually in the back in the personnel carrier part of it, not driving, not gunning. And we would get to our Afghan National Police counterparts, and the infantry guys would go off and do their training with their folks, and we would meet with the usually intelligence folks in the Afghan National Police. Occasionally we go out and do foot patrols, dismounted patrols, throughout some of the villages. See what we see, talk to who we can talk to. Just a presence sometimes in training mission for the police out there.
As you went out, what was the likelihood that there would be some type of an engagement with hostiles, that you'd be shot at, you'd be return fire, what have you? Was it often, not often?
In Kunduz province, not often when I went out. Did I get shot at? Yes. You know, did we get mortars fired up? Yes. But my fingers, my toes, and most of my brain, so I'm pretty happy. There was always a risk. You get into a vehicle and you go outside the wire and you drive down a road that hasn't been driven on in whether it's 24 hours, 6 hours, or 6 months, and those things we call IEDs, improvised explosive devices, could or could not be there. You turn left one day and the next patrol turns right down the same route the next week and you lose everybody in that vehicle. So the risk was there. I would say I was never really thought about the risks so much. And my civilian career, since I was in the Georgia Army National Guard, was a police officer. So I'd already kind of accepted my own mortality. It wasn't something I was terribly worried about.
Helen, in Iraq, you mentioned that, because you mentioned they weren't driving or gunning. And Helen mentioned that when you were in Iraq, you had a very easy job when you went outside the wire, right? No. Don't give me that look. Helen is the only guest I've ever had on the show that I'm super scared of. It's a very healthy, respectful fear, like you have of the Lord. I love you too, Helen, our Savior. But you were a gunner.
I was a door gunner. I was a door gunner in a Blackhawk. Why did you say that was an easy job?
Because I was being facetious and trying to joke, and you didn't laugh, and then I got scared.
We'll talk later.
Please, no. I need my safe space. So you were in Blackhawks as a door gunner?
As a door gunner, yeah. It was a very interesting job. That was not supposed to be my primary mission when I went to Iraq. I was actually the supply sergeant. And I always told my soldiers, when I give you a mission, you have a mission. You have a mission. And do not, if somebody yells out to you, "Hey, you." So I was out at the tarmac and I was looking for somebody, and somebody yelled out, "Hey, you." Me. So Mr. Ware said, "Go get your gear, we leave in 10. Now I have something to go do. So lucky me, got picked for a mission. And I must have did something right, and immediately my mission was changed. So I became a door gunner with Mr. Ware. I got lucky. Mr. Ware was an awesome leader, and I don't have any kids in here. He got all my shit together, and somebody was looking out for us because we had some very wonderful experiences and some not so wonderful experiences, and he helped us with everything. If we had any kind of problem or we were unaware, he helped us get there, get home safely. I owe a lot to him.
When you would go outside the wire, what was the likelihood for you that there would be a hostile engagement of some sort?
You asking me if I ever fired my weapon?
No, because that's a question civilians ask. I'm asking, was it often, whenever you went outside the wire, was it often a hostile engagement? Was it seldom?
Often.
Often.
There was even a time where our bird, we had to put the bird down. And we were lucky enough that they did not have night vision goggles, and we did. And we had to put our backs against each other. And my one soldier, Furry, was like, "This is it. This is what we've been waiting for." And I sat there and thought, "No, I have a daughter at home. I need to get to my daughter." And he's like, "This is what we've been waiting for." But Mr. Ware was, he got us home.
Was he a warrant officer?
Yes.
You call him Mr.
Yes, he was a warrant officer.
If everybody could talk louder, it'd be great.
No problem, ma'am.
I have a comment.
Yeah, feel free, Heather, but you have to talk louder.
Absolutely.
Use that command voice.
I like the bee sweater, by the way.
Heather runs the Scottsville Supply Company, which is a beekeeping supply store down in Scottsville.
Sharing a story that you were a supply sergeant, and then suddenly on a Blackhawk manning the gun. Mm-hmm. So if you know anybody in the military, and they have a job, and then they go to Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever conflict, they might tell you, "I'm doing this job," but what they're really doing over here is usually 100 times different. Mission changes. My job is what I did in intelligence. I wasn't actually a collector. I wasn't supposed to be gathering stuff. I was an analyst. But I loved going outside the wire. Loved it. I had somebody in S6 comms. Ran all of our internet lines the first part of the mission in Iraq. Suddenly, she was doing conflict security, getting our logistical supplies from base to base in a Humvee in Iraq. She should not have been doing that. It wasn't her job.
It was more fun than pulling cable, though.
It was.
Yeah?
Yeah, except now she jumps at fireworks. So.
Well, Bruce, when you were in Vietnam, I want to ask the second question first. How often, when you went outside the wire, would you have a hostile engagement? Seldom? Sometimes? Never? You told me something about a foxhole.
So many different things. That was first war. It was a guerrilla war, And Vietnamese people have been at war for 1,000 years, so they were pretty much experts on doing booby traps and sniping and everything else. So they say 243 days out of a year deployment. Of course, Marines are 400 days, so 300 days you'd have some kind of incident. That could just be one guy hit a booby trap, one guy got, you know, in trouble. But yeah, you just about always had to fill out an incident report every day. But I was only in the wire for 4 months, and then I went up north where there was no wire. Our home was where we dug it. We dug a hole every night. We didn't have a base. We were a battalion landing team, Landing Force Bravo. So we had ships to support us, and we were on ship Christmas Day, and we had dinner there, and we hit the beach at Hue the day after Christmas, so in Amtrak's. So now we didn't have wire in the DMZ. They said 29,000 NVA came across that border in 6 months, and you know, I don't know how many made it back. We were kind of a blocking force, but some of them made it past us, and most didn't.
So moving to garrison life while deployed, and garrison is the name of your base. I mean, that not the name, but, you know, it means your base, your home, where you're living. The second time I went, I went twice just as a contractor. Second time I went, I was in Kandahar. That was my garrison, was Kandahar Airfield. And they promised me on my contract when I went, I would never have to go outside the wire, because I went outside the wire the first trip, and I said, you're not doing this to me again, because I've been blown up too much. And 1 week after arrival, hey, you. Yeah, I got hey-you'd. I went to the middle of nowhere, Afghanistan, to find, I'm not joking, 8 laptops. I had to find 8 laptops in the desert somewhere. We don't know how, and I landed at airbase. I'm like, I'm looking for these guys. Oh, those guys left months ago. But there's a bunch of containers over here. You're more than welcome to go through them. I'm like, oh, this job sucks. But when you're in garrison, the daily life is different for everyone. You may have seen the meme, the photo, welcome to Afghanistan. Your experience may vary, and it has Marines dug into a foxhole covered in muck and mud. And then and I don't know why they're female, but the two female aviators that are drinking coffee at a bean. What is it, coffee bean? Green bean.
Green bean.
Green bean is our Starbucks deployed, and it's all the colors match. And I was that second person in Kandahar where every night I had my frozen chai latte before I went back to my 64-degree server room to go work in for the evening. But when you were in garrison, and Bruce, we're going to start with you, because it sounds like you didn't have a garrison. You had a ship that you were on for Christmas, but food, showers, how did all that stuff happen, or did it?
Yeah, I did say I had two different experiences. I went into Da Nang. I went south. I thought, you know, I went to language school for 6 months. I'm going to probably be an interpreter. So that was pretty cool. So Captain Gibbs said, "You're in first platoon. Here's your fire team. Go, you know, and we're going on Operation Union tomorrow, and they'll tell you what you got to do." So I was all of a sudden, every Marine's a 0311 rifleman, and so I went back to my original MOS. There was no consideration for my secondary MOS at all, and so I was a point rifleman within a week, and we kicked butt. Unfortunately, we kicked butt the first week. I made stars and stripes because we were on a listening post. They've always put the brand new guys out on the listening post because we're most expendable. And these two columns of NBA came up the path, and we blew claymores and ran like heck back to the lines, and they called in naval guns. And I said, this war's not so bad. You know, we kicked butt. But it didn't last.
That was at the beginning of the experience.
That was the first week. It got, and it went downhill. So,
speaking to the idea that Uncle Sam, we sometimes call him Uncle Sugar. Uncle Sugar doesn't always spend money in the best of ways. You were trained for 6 months to speak Vietnamese as an interpreter, as a linguist. Mm-hmm. How often did you actually use that in country?
Well, I used it when we did go back to garrison. We had wire. We had a perimeter, and south of Da Nang, it was called the Rocket Belt, and we had this a TOR that we were responsible for. and we do combat patrols every day, search and destroy missions, and we do night ambushes every night. So then we pull perimeter duty, of course. But I guess we did have these hooches, and they had sandbags up so far, and we had cots. So it wasn't too bad when you were there. You weren't there that often, but you were there. And we had a shower that they kept shooting holes in. It was a 55-gallon barrel. So we didn't. It never had water in it, seems like.
War is hell. They blew up our Pizza Hut one day in Kandahar. Oh, that was a bad day. It's a bad day for the... What? Don't mock me. I remember hearing that mortar round land. I'm like, that was really close. And everyone was pissed in the headquarters. I'm like, why is everyone so angry? They blew up the pizza oven. I'm like... They just got the pizza oven yesterday. Oh, this war.
Their intel's good.
I know. Their intel's really good. It's almost like they're on the base. But we'll talk about green on blue in a minute. Helen, when you were in Iraq and or Afghanistan, what was garrison life? Now, I know that Iraq and Afghanistan were very different, and we were so good at fighting in Iraq, when troops would transition over to Afghanistan, they had two rules, which was... wear your reflective safety belt, and this isn't Iraq. And that's what we were always briefed. But what was garrison like for both?
When I was in Iraq, it was 2003 and 2004.
So right at the beginning.
It was pretty in the beginning. It was tent city. And, yeah, so that wasn't always fun. The moment you took a shower, it was usually a dust storm, so why even bother? And we always had this joke, you know, I've been wearing the shirt for 5 days, and your friend would be like, no, you're good, here, you wear the shirt. Dude, you wore that shirt yesterday, you know, and it's like, ooh. The first time I got to Afghanistan was it... Oh, God, that was the time they held us over. So that was 2006 to 2008. That was the time that 10th Mountain got held over. And
you'll have to explain what held over means, because most of them won't know what that means.
Oh, it was wonderful. half of 10th Mountain had left. They landed in Germany. They refueled them, and they made them come back.
They told them they were going home.
Yes. I was on the tarmac. They told us our plane broke down. Go back to your tents. That was the worst for 10th Mountain, because we had a lot of suicides. Half of my platoon went into the orange groves and decided to end it. A lot of spouses said they don't want to stay married. So, yeah, that was the worst for 10th Mountain. That was really hard. So we had tents, and then they started to give us billets. Not the cement billets.
Bee huts?
Yeah, that's what it was called, bee huts.
So, but bee huts are basically plywood buildings that meet no OSHA requirements in the slightest bit, nor EPA or any type of health code. So food was always snuck in, and then... the mice would show up, or the spiders.
Well, that wasn't too bad. I had had, because I would go outside the wire, and I had came home one night, and I lay down, and I felt something. And I jumped up, threw everything across the room, and opened my pillow, shined it on. A mother had made a nice little nest underneath my pillow. Like, oh, this is great.
A mother of
rats.
Kittens?
Sorry, rats.
Kittens. Rats.
Rats. So a few days later, then we had snake problems. Well, that cured the mice. So that was that.
Yeah, we had hawk problems for a while, but then that one cleared up.
So, yeah, spiders was nothing compared to that. And then... 2012, that was the year I got medevaced out. They just started putting, what was the tent? No. You had it, because you were there in 2012. correct? The metal containers, they look like...
We had
oh, the Connexes. Yeah.
That's it. Yes, the Connexes. And everybody thought, wow, this is great.
Shipping containers.
Yes.
Now,
and shipping containers.
It is the new hotness in millennial design on HGTV. Let's take these shipping containers and build them into a nice home. And we're looking at it going... Oh.
But it's fantastic because you go from living in a tent where you have 21 females to living in shipping containers where there's two to a shipping containers. That's awesome.
Yeah, I didn't say that. I went from tents in Iraq, tents and cots, to a shipping container with a bed. It was luxury.
Yeah. And you had air condition. But one person controlled the air condition because they had it on their side, so...
You'll be thrilled to know that I started in the air-conditioned, it's called a wet CHU, containerized housing unit, CHU, a CHU. I had a wet one, which means I had my own bathroom and shower. And by the end of my deployment, I was living in a 20-person tent across the street from the poop pond in Kandahar at the end of my time. The poop pond is a giant lake of exactly what you think it is.
So you actually had a latrine inside your...
It was just, when I first got there, my own toilet.
That's not fair.
I got payback by the end of it. I was across the street from all of the latrines.
Good. My latrine was 320 steps from my,
I love how this is called Stories of Courage, and right now we're talking about how long it takes me to go to take a crap. I mean, 320 steps to get out there and... I'm very much the model of decorum, by the way. You should see him when I have him on the radio show.
Why were you medevac?
Yeah, that's actually where I was going to, was worst day. Your worst day of what... And I told them beforehand, they can share to the level that they want to share. And I think that we all can agree that that is more than acceptable. So, Helen, your worst day while you were deployed. Well, he did ask the question, and I figured that's going to be your worst day, right?
No, it's okay, because Astro and I travel now, speaking about veteran suicide and this. When my two tours in Afghanistan, I got reclassified, and I became a FET team, female engagement team, to make it short. A small group of females that are... knowledgeable in the culture and the language, and there would be maybe four of us integrated into a infantry platoon, and we would patrol the areas with them, and if we came up on anything from knocking down doors to maybe there's a school and there's females that maybe needed to be searched or talked to, so a riot came out. And we were trying to contain the riot. And before I could get my gun trucks situated, a suicide bomber started walking towards me. And I went to go radio to my gun truck because he was up high in the MRAP. And I lost sight of the boy. And he stepped into the crowd and detonated himself. Myself and my squad got medevaced up to Larnstuhl, and then later I got Walter Reed. I was there for 6 months, learning to walk, because the world was tilted to me, learning to talk, count. I now wear a hearing aid. I walk downstairs with the help of Astro. He's my lifeline. He's my battle bud. These last 5 years have been amazing with him. He's my dude. He is my best friend. And I couldn't make it without him. He was given to me by Canines for Warriors shortly after I was medevaced out. And I would not be sitting here today if it wasn't for him. I was married to a soldier, but that soldier had never seen combat, so he couldn't understand why I came home different, why I see stuff different. He would say to me, forget about it.
you're home with me now. And it's not that easy. You don't switch off that switch. So, our marriage became narcissistic. He blamed me for losing my soldiers. And I had a lot of guilt for that. I have a wonderful daughter, and I missed most of her upbringing, and I had a lot of guilt over that. I'm learning to live with not seeing her grow up, but I'm very proud now because she's graduating college next few weeks, and she's got hired by Border Patrol. So I did something right. So being married to him, I started taking my medication with alcohol to deal with him. And one day he went to work, and I sat down on my couch with my weapon in my mouth. And Astro brought me his tennis ball. No matter how hard I threw that tennis ball, he kept bringing it back to me. And I think he was saying, I need you. Sorry.
It's perfectly, perfectly.
And yeah, he's my dude. He's my plus one. So I packed up my Jeep with all his stuff, and that was 2 years ago, and I moved to Virginia. So he has brought me on this wonderful journey, and he has taught me that don't let things bother you. Wag your tail and move on, and things are okay. So yeah.
Well, I'm personally glad that you came to Virginia, because I got to meet you.
I know.
Helen has been on the show more than anyone else, because Helen's awesome. Thank you, Evan. Astro's pretty cool, too.
Astro's the best.
Yes, you are. So I'm going to change the question slightly for Heather, because as you were talking, Helen... Oh, no, please blow your nose while I'm pointing you out. So what you get when you have a stand-up comic doing your interviews. As you were talking about being medevaced out, and you didn't explain, but by all means, on that card, go to the website and download her podcast, where it's a conversation with Helen Stowe about service dogs. We've talked about service dogs. Mm-hmm. I've had you back on to talk about female engagement teams. I had you back on a third time, and I can't remember what in the world it was about. Was it
invisible
fart jokes?
Disabilities.
Yeah, invisible disabilities. Same thing. Both she and I have a very similar disability. That's why we crack jokes. But as you were talking and explaining that you were medevaced out, you were covered in shrapnel, that they were pulling all kinds of pieces of shrapnel out of you, you had to relearn how to walk, you had to go through so much rehabilitation, and I asked a bad question, which was your worst day, and instead, just above your head is the phrase, stories of courage. And it wasn't necessarily your worst day as much as it was the day that began this courageous fight that you fought. And that impressed the hell out of me. And I know that he's your lifeline, but also understand that you're at the other end of the leash. And a lot of that comes back to you. That is a story of courage. And I personally appreciate you sharing that.
Thank you.
Helen talked about self-medicating. I think probably most returning veterans do self-medicate, and then, of course, you go to the VA finally, and they tend to give you drugs, too. So, I mean, that seems to be the answer, but it's not the right answer, obviously. But they're on the right track with a puppy dog there. And I guess my worst day probably in Vietnam was when we hit the beach north of Hue. And And I didn't get really injured. But we lost 49 young men from my company, of my battalion, 81 wounded. And I was at NJIG today, and they made us share some stories at the Marine Corps birthday. My colonel, who happened to live in Charlottesville, he was my captain in Vietnam. He lives in Charlottesville. I'm very lucky to have him. I took him there, and he cut the cake. He was the oldest Marine. And he shared some stories. And then I thought about that day. I didn't share that story, but I thought about that day. And, you know, they didn't know what traumatic brain injury was. You know, if you grab two grenades and try to play John Wayne, get up out of the creek and throw them and get your helmet shot through, and you got one grenade off, the other one went right in front of you and blew up, didn't hit you because you fell back in the creek when you got hit, but that you get knocked out. But they did not call it. There was no such thing as TBI. No such thing at that time. And so I don't remember a whole lot that day. But people say, you know, how can the Vietnam vets, they won every battle, right? How can they lose the war? But, you know, we didn't win every day. We might, the battle, we pursued it the next day. But, yeah, that was a terrible day. Lost my company commander. We lost every NCO. We had some bad days. And a guy was telling our colonel when he mentioned that. We talked about some good days we had, too. But, mainly, I guess those bad days when I came home from Vietnam, we didn't talk about them. You know, I self-medicated with alcohol. Fortunately, my wife stuck around. She stuck by me, Johnny. I don't know why, but she did. And it'll be 49 years, right? But she's, I quit drinking 30 years ago. I had to. I was going to run over somebody or something. I was very lucky. My daughter's here. My grandkids are here. Life is good. I'm very lucky that I had people to stick by me. The Vietnam vets tried to welcome home this new breed of vets. They have multiple deployments. It's crazy. Y'all go back and you go back again and again, and it's amazing that you hold it together. I don't see how, you know, you do. But there is a lot of suicides, but there is a lot of programs in the area, Living Free, and different programs with that people are finally starting to realize that, you know, that they can certainly make a difference. And our community is starting to really support, I believe they are, really support the veterans. Do they understand us? Probably not. And you guys, I don't even understand y'all's lingo, and I speak Vietnamese fluently. So, but anyway, we're different generations, but we're sisters and brothers. The Marines are looking for a few good women, you know.
Yeah. Anyway, you mentioned the coming home process, and really that's my shtick with the show is to educate what the coming home situation is, and to see how different it is. And when you came back, based on what you said, you did not feel welcome, but how unwelcome did you feel? Was it I'm done with that part of my life, I'm running away from it? Because you're now the president of the American Legion. So it seems that at some point you've embraced your veteran nature and your military service.
I did, but it took a long time, Bob. It took about 30 years before I did. I didn't talk about Vietnam to anybody, did I? So I didn't talk about Vietnam. Matter of fact, I bought a chopper from your husband, two bushel baskets. Miss Betty's my friend, as a chopper, and I put a chopper together. That's kind of my healing to come back. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I got this chopper and I.
Oh, a motorcycle! I'm thinking a helicopter. I'm like, Betty, you're selling helicopters?
No, it was in two bushel baskets. It was a Harley.
It was a Harley. Yeah.
So anyway, I put it together, had a chrome dagger for the shifter, and I had a clutch, suicide clutch, and it was a dangerous damn bike. I don't know why you sold it to me. And it was your husband. But anyway, I actually we were, I guess, kind of weekend hippies. I had a VW van, and she made tie-dye curtains, red, white, and blue ones.
I love your family so much more now.
I went to Miami-Dade Junior College, and I blended in. My next-door neighbor was Angela Davis, one of the Chicago Seven. She had a coffin for her coffee table. She didn't know any different. She never knew I went to Vietnam. So we lived in a place called the Zoo. It was a Nile Gardens apartment. But we blended in, and I guess I didn't talk about Vietnam for 30 years. And I came back to Charlottesville, finally. Got back. I was a commercial diver in Texas for many years and stuff. And we came back to Charlottesville, and a gentleman named, you know, we lost 28 young men from Charlottesville in Vietnam. Most of them were drafted. So I'm president of the Dogwood Vietnam Memorial. And the reason I call it the Hill at Heels, that hill helped me heal. It made me address my demons, so to speak. And then I spoke there in 95, and I've been working with that ever since. So there, and then I gradually picked up more and more things to do, which is commander of the American Legion Post, 800 members, and I would love to have a woman commander of that post.
Yeah. So, Heather, when you came home, I mean, Bruce didn't talk about Vietnam for 30 years, but when you came home, it was during the height of Thank You for Your Service, and welcome back. Did you feel welcome, or did you still feel a little disconnected?
No, I came back 3 times, thankfully. Right. But I felt welcome. Every time. I have an uncle who came home from Vietnam, same sort. So I feel very fortunate to who I came home to, which is all of you. You know, you guys make the difference today. You really do. And just talking to other veterans helps.
Helen, when you came home, whether it be Iraq or Afghanistan, and you already shared the experience of coming back from Afghanistan when you were blown up, basically, but did you feel, because you came back from Iraq in what, 2004?
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like the coming home was, I mean, did you feel welcomed by the community when you came back? Was it much like, how comfortable did you feel when you came back?
That time, I don't think I was listening to anyone because I came back a very angry person. I was not nice. I didn't even want to be my friend. I had all walls up. Yeah, I was very bitter, very angry, and I didn't want to listen to anyone. Yeah, that was a bad time in my life.
What changed?
Probably my daughter.
How so?
Yeah. Just looking and listening to her more and seeing just that little part of her grow. 'Cause 10th Mountain was on rotation big time, like all the time going. And as soon as I knew that we were back up for rotation again, I was like, oh, I better take that little precious time I have right now because we're ready to leave again. It's like, wait a minute, wait, I just got home. Yeah.
And this is for any of you. What was the hardest part of coming home that you wish you could change? Just one thing. From your own experiences, not talking about the current warfighters that are deployed right now, which, by the way, we still have people in Iraq, just so you know, a few thousand.
Obviously, for me, it would be drinking a fifth of scotch every day. There's only $1 a bottle at the PX, so, and it was a full quart. It wasn't just a fifth. But I did that for about 3 months when I got back. And then, of course, I got married, and I cut it back to beer only, but I was still self-medicating. You know, so. Yeah, I'd change that if I could. I don't have that luxury, but I would definitely change that.
I think the hardest part about coming home is knowing you're going to go right back. Just when.
You feel the same, Helen?
Yeah.
Feeling like you aren't actually back, it's just a temporary stay.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It was a lot easier being over there than coming home.
Why? Because that's something civilians don't get at all, but I get it. And my wife loves me, even though I say, gosh, I wish I was in Afghanistan right now. It'd be amazing.
I knew who my soldiers were. I knew their routine. I knew my routine. Just being home was unpredictable, and it's still even unpredictable at home. Help me out here. Folks, jump in anytime.
I'll agree with that. I mean, for certain jobs out there, you had a job. It was the only thing you did every day when you got up. You know, you grabbed your rifle and you went to work. You know, you didn't, we had cooks, we had mess halls. You went and got your chow, somebody else fixed it for you, somebody washed your dishes, took out your trash, and you went to work, whether you were working nights or days or 24 hours or 36 hours. It was almost simple.
I like simple and routine, and he gets me in a routine. We get up, I make my coffee, I feed him, he knows. When I'm done with my two cups of coffee, he goes for his walk. That's great.
We have just a couple minutes left. Any last questions for sir? Wait, yes. Isn't he yours? He can ask you in the car. Anyone else? All right, go ahead. You'll be our last questioner.
I would ask if there's one thing that you want people to know about your war experience or yourself, what would it be? Civilians, what would you want civilians to know?
We're almost normal, you know. We can be.
Speak
I think
so.
We're not like Bob.
Oi!
Captain Bob. Okay. We wish we were like Bob. Okay.
We do.
How about that?
They're very pretty dresses.
I know one thing I'm struggling with now, and I love Astro, and I need Astro. I'm not just bringing a dog along because he makes me look better. But it gets very hard when I'm in a grocery store and people go, look, a dog. Oh, look, a dog. Look at the dog. Look at the dog. It makes me feel like I'm a three-ring circus. And I want to just drop my groceries and go out. I don't even want to be there. And then I sit at home with no food. I'm just happy in my little box because they make me feel like I'm a clown. And then I get the guts to go out, and then I see a mom with her baby. Look at the dog. Look at the dog. And here I am. I'm a three-ring circus. So please tell your family, your kids, whoever you're with, just ignore us. You would never tell someone, look at the wheelchair. Look at the wheelchair. You wouldn't do that. So tell your friends, don't do that to us. Because it really makes me feel like that's all I ask.
If I may add on, during one of the, I interview a lot of service dog organizations, and one of the trainers once said to me, if you replace the word dog with the word boobs, and the sentence sounds inappropriate, don't say it. Well, I wish I could bring my boobs out in public. Oh, look at those boobs. I was stunned at first, and then I went, that really works.
I'm glad you said that, because I said that to someone one time. They were like...
They probably told it to me.
They probably did. I said, service dogs look like a very fancy, pretty bra. Everybody wants to touch it, but you know you can't.
I gave Astor a really big hug, so I have Heather, did you want to? I have terrible jokes right now.
You know, sometimes we behave differently. I leave crowded areas a lot. I leave my wife to wait for the table and go back outside. I can't do it. Threat of suicide bombers.
We left the shades up.
Can I ask one last?
Oh, geez, we're over time, man. You're even a librarian. You know better. All right, fine. Are you guys okay with just a few more minutes for the late librarian to...
Did Bruce want to finish first?
Oh, I thought Bruce did answer. He was going to tell you in the car.
We're almost normal. But I guess maybe I ought to ask you that question about me. You know me pretty good. For 22 years, you've known me, right? So we'll turn it on you. Dick, he just graduated from... He's going to be a PA. He self-diagnoses everything. So this young man is very, very smart, a lot smarter than I was. What do you think? What would you say? You've volunteered at the Vietnam Museum. Actually, we went down to downtown Charlottesville, took a 106 recoilless rifle on a Jeep down there, Lee Park, for the 250th anniversary of Charlottesville. They let us take it down. Guess what he was carrying? AK-47s and a RPG. And he showed everybody down in Charlottesville how to, and they were real. He showed them how to use them. I mean, we were educating, and they welcomed us down there. My granddaughters were down there with flowers, and we had a VW van that I drove down there with the flowers all on it, and they were hippies. My wife was a protester. We tried to show the whole story, and they had flowers, and they were putting them in the barrels of the rifles so the guys that were marching around. But Nick, you've been around the Vietnam vets a long time. What do you say? You're a volunteer at the museum.
I think the biggest thing that I want for Vietnam vets and all veterans in general is that they're welcome home, like we talked about earlier. I know that's a I don't know if I'm qualified to comment on it, but you know, Vietnam vets were spit on when they got home from Vietnam, called baby killers. There were riots, many things, and I think that that's appalling to most of us. And so I think that that's my biggest thing for Vietnam specifically, is that I want those veterans to be welcomed home, and I want all veterans to be welcomed home, and I think we should continue to do that.
Yeah. Thanks. I feel normal now.
Stick with me, kid. I'll take you to some weird places. Sir, your question.
Well, that's a pretty good place to stop. My question was just about what have you seen with civilians when they've done it right, and what would you recommend? From, I mean, I don't have military in my family anywhere until I moved to Virginia. I didn't know anybody in the military. And so my experience is from way far up there. And, but I don't want to feel like I'm a total stranger.
Now, I like that as the last question. Examples of civilians getting it right.
Well, they start out right until we mess them up. We had 93 CHS students at the museum last Wednesday. They were there all day. They brought their lunch. They went for a tour, and we had 15 students in a group. We went to stations. We had about 6 volunteers at different stations. So you go into the museum, you get to see your draft notice at the van, and you hit your van. You go over to the airplane, you see the bricks, and you see... We have 4 airplanes. We do have 2 Hueys and Puff and Magic Dragon. Of course, I'll put in another plug for the museum. It's last weekend. It's
I was going to plug it. Man, you stole my
thing. It's moving. It's being shut down.
So the Vietnam War Museum up in Rutgersville, this is its final weekend. It is the largest hands-on museum that covers the Vietnam experience. If you've never been there, you have to go just to see the paintings on the walls, because when you talk about caisson, you just know it was bad, but you don't know why. And then when you see the mortar pit that they have set up and painted on the wall as the rest of caisson, you really can go, that was a crappy place to go. You can pretty much touch most everything. Juggling the cluster bombs is fun if you know how to juggle. They're most of them are inert. But this weekend is the final weekend. It's 10 to 4, I want to say.
10 to 4 on Sunday and Monday.
10 to 4 Sunday, Monday. If you don't know how to find it or something, just look up Vietnam War Museum Rutgersville in the Googler, and you can get on out there. It's behind someone's house, which is an alpaca farm. So when you start down the dirt road, you're like, whose house am I going to? And you see alpacas. You're in the right place. Yeah. Sorry.
So I'm sorry. I got off track a little bit. But these young people are so inspiring. They ask questions, and they're not judgmental at all. They just want to know. And you can tell that they are really learning something, and a lot more than our leaders did back in the day. So we got hope for the future, and I think we all have to be go back to being like a kid and realizing we're, you know, they're innocent, so to speak, but we did have to pull one of them out of the chopper, but over there, a couple of them got in the back of the chopper, but I'm just kidding. It was inspiring to see these young people, how they did interviews, and they do YouTube presentations you wouldn't believe. We got smart kids coming along, and all you got to do is listen. I guess you learn a lot more from listening, don't you? So I think that's all you. If you can listen to a vet, that is a world of good for them. Thank you,
Heather.
The things that I've seen civilians do right, you guys, most of you, a few veterans in here, leaving and coming home on those commercial jetliners, there were always groups at the airport to send you off and to bring you home, to shake your hand, to give you hugs, to give you American flags. Just knowing that you guys care, showing up here tonight, it's doing it right.
Helen?
Listening, yeah, on what you're doing tonight. You know, whether the crowd is big or small, that helps.
I'm going to agree with them. Definitely the moment when you guys get it right, and forgive me for saying you guys, we were all civilians at one point until we got screwed up by basic. But caring to be here and to learn how to help us have hope again, to learn how to be part of our team, we're not going to be able to go back to civilian life like we were before we were in. And we're not asking you to do it either. We don't want that. That's why we volunteered. Forgive me, Bruce. Most of us volunteered. Did you volunteer or were you drafted?
I was 4A, which meant I was going to get a draft notice, and I did get a draft notice. But I'd already talked to a Marine recruiter, two of my buddies. We were going on the buddy team in the Marine Corps, and they said, well, I'm not ready to go yet. And I said, well, I got to go because I just got a draft notice. So I went to the recruiter and said, I'm ready, and he got me on a train to Paris Island within the next day. So, I guess technically I joined, but I was pretty motivated, as everybody was back then.
Understandable. So we know what it's like, and we also are willing to take that mantle from the civilian population so that you don't have to see the stuff that they've seen and do the things that they've done and heard the things or smelled the smells that they've smelled. We don't want you to have those nightmares. But what we would like is for you to understand that we do have those nightmares, and it's okay for us to have those nightmares right now, and we'll work through them. But we're not going to get back to where we were. I would say that we've evolved a little bit. And if you can communicate with us better and learn our language, that is probably the best possible thing. Segue plug notice alert. Hence the show Coming Home Well, which you have a postcard. Please take the postcards. And please, a very sincere thank you. A round of applause for our guests would be fantastic.
I really enjoyed hearing each of them share their stories.
Yeah, it was nice to hear so many different perspectives. This podcast is made possible through generous support from the Friends of the Library. If you'd like to learn more or join the Friends, please head to their website at jmrlfriends.org.
Please hit subscribe wherever it is you're listening to the podcast. If you have books that you'd like us to read and discuss, or topics that you'd like to hear on a future episode, please email us at podcast@jmrl.org. That's all for us today, but we'll be back in 2 weeks with more content from library events. Thanks for tuning in, and we're glad to be
on the same page.